Tsunamis, earthquakes, floods, nuclear meltdowns. Seems like there's no shortage of disasters lately. This hour, we'll talk with writer Joel Achenbach about why he says we're living in the century of disasters, how you can prepare. Plus,
we'll also do more to retrofit America for a global economy. That means updating the way we get our electricity by starting to build a new smart grid.
That's President Obama in 2009 talking about upgrading our electrical grid. As we head into this season of brownouts, are we making any progress toward a smart grid? What engineering breakthroughs are needed? Some consumers are not sold on smart meters that can read their power usage minute by minute. What do you think? Some answers and your questions after this break. Stay with us.
Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, hoping you'll bear with me as I hack my way through my last days of laryngitis, so please bear with those squeaks. I have nothing to do with them. From tsunamis to nuclear meltdowns to floods and wildfires, you know, sometimes it seems like we're moving from one disaster to the next. Is this true? Are there more disasters now, or are we just more aware of them? My next guest says maybe it's a bit of both. In an article for Slate magazine, Joel Achenbach writes that the 21st century will be known as the century of natural disasters and technological crises and unholy combinations of the two. But he's here to tell us why we shouldn't worry and at the same time how to prepare. Joel Achenbach is a reporter and science writer for The Washington Post. His latest book is A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be on this great show you have, so thank you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have you on to talk about it, because I know you've written many, many books, seven books, and you've written a lot about disasters, oil spills. You've been a reporter for the Post for 21 years. Does it seem to you like it does to us that we're seeing more disasters now than ever?
Lately, it seems like that's all I cover are disasters. You know, it's the Mississippi River flood, the Japan tragedy, the Fukushima meltdown after that. I'm really glad that solar flare this week didn't hit us directly because, you know, here in Washington, it's about 98 degrees. It's been this way all week, and I would not have wanted a solar flare disaster to knock out the transformers on the grid. I know you have guests going to talk about that, but that is one of the sort of potential calamities that could happen out there when you have, I mean, essentially what we have here is a planet with 7 billion people living in many cases in large cities that are in seismically hazardous places or are vulnerable to tsunamis. There's a lot of people and a lot of stuff vulnerable to these ancient forces. Plus, we have all of our systems, our grids, our nuclear power plants. Or last year, we saw what happened with the deep water drilling. That's what my book was about, is the BP disaster. So the technology creates these systems that are vulnerable to catastrophic failure.
So we have the systems and technology in place that we never had 25 or 30 years ago. And we have more people living near those things than we didn't have before.
If you go back to 1800, the year 1800, there was one city in the world that had 1 million people, and that was Beijing. The most recent count I've come across is that there are 381 cities with at least 1 million people. Of those cities, a lot of them are in seismically very hazardous places like Caracas, Venezuela, or Mexico City, or Kathmandu. And if you're living in a city and you are poor, you're not going to worry about events that don't happen but once every 200 years or so. This is the future. This is going to happen because a lot of these people live in homes that are not well built. If you look what happened in Haiti last year, I mean, yes, an earthquake caused the disaster, but what really killed people were buildings, the lack of rebar, the fact that they were living in unreinforced structures. And so a lot of people around the world are in those kind of conditions and are sort of sitting ducks because of the seismic hazard. There was a study by, I think it was Roger Billum at the University of Colorado, that said that 403 million people on the planet today live in places with significant seismic hazard.
You say these things are black swan events. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a term that was popularized a few years ago by Nassim Taleb in a book he wrote called The Black Swan, in which he talked about these events sort of out of the blue that are game changers. And people have said that 9/11 was a black swan, or that the housing collapse and the financial crisis of 2008 was a black swan. Inevitably, these events actually have precursors. I mean, they are predictable at some level. I mean, 9/11 didn't really come out of the blue. It just seemed that way. If you're in government or in a policy position, you have to figure out, how do we prepare for events that are low probability but high consequence? So, for example, last year, the Deepwater Horizon blowout, it was a black swan event. No one saw that coming. When it happened, I can testify as a newspaper reporter, we didn't understand what we were looking at. We didn't realize that this was a blowout, and this fire on the rig that killed 11 people was going to begin this 3 or 4 or 5 month disaster that we were going to be covering every day on the front page. We just didn't know what we were looking at because it was so unfamiliar to us. And I think that's one thing that if you're, in a policy position, if you're the head of FEMA or the president of the United States, you need to be aware that you don't get to pick your next disaster. You don't get to decide, what is going to be the big issue in July, looking at it from the perspective of early June, because you just don't know. And so the answer is, how do you become resilient, adaptable, flexible, and able to respond quickly and with some grace when things go bad?
You know, on the other hand, we're seeing hurricanes of unprecedented strength. We're seeing floods of that are huge, that they haven't seen in the history of the Mississippi. We're seeing tornadoes that are a mile wide. I mean, it's hard to say that, we have not entered an era of bigger, greater, giant disasters.
Well, climate change is arguably a huge disaster in and of itself. It hasn't played out, to the extent that it will. I mean, it is a fact we're in a warming planet, and all the models would predict that as climate change, as the planet warms, you're going to have more moisture in the atmosphere. You're going to have larger flooding events, more intense droughts. I don't know that you could say that the flood in the Mississippi this year is because of climate change. I know that it annoys people, but I stick to the formulation that you can't attribute a single event to climate change. But it is reasonable to say that we're loading the dice, that we're setting ourselves up for trouble, and that over time, rapid climate change, if it happens quickly and severely, could outpace our ability to adapt to it. And we don't really know how it will play out entirely. It creates a lot of uncertainty. And so I think that, at the very least, the people who run this country and who make decisions around the world need to, face the facts about climate change, that this is real. It's not a hoax. This is not something, it didn't stop in 1998. Global warming didn't stop in 1998. And the carbon dioxide is steadily going up in the atmosphere, and there's going to be consequences of that.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Okay, now that we have alarmed everybody.
Exactly. I know. Have a nice day.
Well, but you stay, and you say, don't worry. I mean, we've talked about all the reasons why we should worry.
Well, what I would say, first of all, is, I worry, am I going to be able to pay for college tuition? I worry, are my tomatoes going to actually bear fruit this summer in my backyard? I don't walk around worrying that the sky is going to fall. I do think that people ought to be aware that the grid could go out for a week or two or longer. In fact, getting back to the solar flares, I mean, one of the concerns is you could lose the grid for many months. You could have if a flare were to take out the transformers, and there's been some research on that recently. You know, I think people need to understand that not every day is going to go as planned, and the technology doesn't always work. I mean, one thing that jumped out at me from doing my book was that here you had this the offshore oil drilling industry. Lots of very brilliant engineering goes into drilling holes in mile deep water. It's amazing that they can do it. I mean, these rigs are ships that are dynamically positioned and able to reach these reservoirs that are not only below a mile of water, but then they're another 2.5 miles down below in the formation. And this technology is stunning to behold, but it's not necessarily quite as robust as the engineers would hope. We saw that when the blowout preventer was unable to seal the well, what we have is an engineered planet now. We have increasingly put ourselves in the grips of these complex systems that can fail in complex ways. You look what happened in Fukushima. There you got these six nuclear reactors. All six had problems, not just because there was a big earthquake and then a tsunami. The problem was they lost electricity. Never mind how it happened. They lost electricity, and those systems were not designed to cool the nuclear fuel rods and so on if they lost electricity. So I would say that people need to be aware that complex systems don't always work as planned. And so if I can just ramble here for another second, let's talk about climate change and geoengineering. Are you sure you want to do that? Are you sure you want to invest a lot of technology in trying to cool the planet artificially? Will that system work as planned?
So be careful before you get what you're asking for, is what you're
saying.
Yeah,
be careful what you ask for. I guess I don't mean to scare people. I mean, I just think that one thing that people need to do is listen to Science Friday, okay? read a book occasionally about science and technology, figure out how the systems around you work. You know, where does electricity come from? What is electricity? You know, where does your water come from? Have some sense that, you know, that we live embedded in this engineered
And be ready for disaster when it strikes.
Well, just, you know, buy some batteries, not only for yourself, but for your neighbor who's not going to remember to buy batteries, who's going to come asking to borrow some.
I've seen that Twilight Zone episode. Yeah. Well, thank you, Joel, for taking time to be with us and being there.
I hope people enjoyed it.
Well, I think you got to be scared. It's a good motivating factor.
Not scared, just focused.
Focused.
Just aware.
Okay. We'll take that thought with us, Joel. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
All right. Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Joel Achenbach is a reporter and science writer for The Washington Post. His latest book is A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about new infrastructure and talk about that grid. That grid that Joel mentioned, what happened with the solar flare? Did it affect the grid? It actually did. And the grid survived. And we'll talk about it when we get back. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code science. Make your next meeting a go-to meeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, an update on our electrical grid. Here's a headline, an interesting headline that caught my eye this week. It's from Thursday of last week. Power outage closes FERC offices. Now, if you don't know what FERC, it's one of those great Washington Beltway abbreviations for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's the federal agency responsible for maintaining electric grid reliability across the U.S. And, of course, the irony here is that a blackout forced them to close their offices. And if we can't keep the lights on for people in charge of maintaining the grid, what does that mean for the rest of us? It's not even summer yet, and we've already had a couple of 100-degree days here on the East Coast, the Southwest. Air conditioners are humming. Can our groaning grid withstand the load? How far along are we in moving toward the so-called smart grid? What kinds of engineering challenges remain to modernize a grid that will function more like the internet or a network that can easily take power from other alternative sources like wind and solar? These are some of the issues we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour. Let me introduce my guest. Eric Gunther is Chair and Chief Technology Officer for Enernex. He is also Senior Member of the IEEE. That's the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And he's a member of the IEEE Smart Grid Task Force. He's here in our New York studios. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. That's a privilege to be invited.
Well, thank you. Karen Herter is president of Herter Energy Research Solutions in El Dorado Hills, California. She joins us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Karen Herter, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's a real honor to be here.
Let's talk about that solar flare that was mentioned earlier in the program. I have a little note here that was measured.
Yeah, there was a way to measure it. The Electric Power Research Institute has a network of monitoring devices. They're continuing to expand that measure directly the impact on our large transformers that was mentioned in the earlier segment. And there was a measurable impact, but very small, nothing to be concerned about. So we had a near miss. The majority of the coronal mass ejection went towards Mars, and without a grid there, we didn't really have anything to worry about.
It says here between 2 and 5 amps. That's like your TV set, you know.
So. Yeah, well, yeah, it's a small amount of current, and, 10 to 100 times more would have been bad.
How does it get into the grid? To the wires, the actual wires, the high-tension wires that strung up everywhere?
Yeah, what happens is a large current gets induced due to the event from the sun, and it looks like a large direct current due to the exposure from the transmission lines, and it's felt most by the transformers. And when it sees that direct current, it's normally used to alternating current, it causes the transformer to behave in ways we don't like. And it can be very quickly overloaded and fail if the protection equipment can trip it offline like happened in 1989 in Quebec.
How much have we learned from that 1989 in Quebec?
Well, we learned quite a bit. Understand the breadth of the effects that can occur, how to measure and monitor the impacts, the impact it'll have on the protective relaying equipment that's used to keep the grid operating.
But is it the same grid, basically?
It's the same grid. The difference is we're using it a lot more. We're relying more and more on the transmission lines to move power from one area to the other. Some of our transmission facilities and transformers are running at higher levels of their capacity than we've seen in the past. And all of those kinds of things makes it a little bit more of a problem if we have an event and we trip a number of them offline.
You know, we were talking before. I say that one of the great jokes in nuclear fusion is that it's always 30 years away. Well, it almost seems like we've been on Science Friday now over 20 years. We've been talking about the electric grid for 20 years. And it always seems like it real soon now it's going to get fixed. You know?
Well, I mean, it's a large infrastructure made up of lots of equipment, some very simple, some very complex. And just like a bridge, it needs periodic maintenance, needs periodic replacement. The components only have a finite lifetime. One of the problems we face is that a whole lot of the infrastructure was built all around the same time. So we have quite a bit of it that is aging and coming to near end of life in one shot. So a lot of the things we're trying to do with Smart Grid is to find ways to delay as long as we can the need to make those wholesale replacements, extract more out of what we have.
Dr. Herter, what is the difference then between the grid and a smart grid? Does the term smart grid mean something entirely new, or is it a matter of building on what we have already?
It's really the latter. I mean, it's adding on to what we already have. The grid that we have, you start with power plants where you generate electricity. That gets sent over the transmission lines, which then gets sent to the distribution lines, which is what most people think of as the telephone poles that are outside their home, to your meters on your home or maybe on your business. And when you want to make it a smart grid, what the utilities are adding distribution automation. They're adding advanced metering infrastructure. And in the future, what we're hoping to do is add some consumer technologies that allow consumers to become more involved in what's going on in the grid.
How much of this is a big engineering challenge, and how much is it using stuff we already know how to do?
It's mainly using stuff we already know how to do, but it's still a challenge getting all of the people and networks working together to get it in place.
All those people, different interests. Is it something that takes slowly putting different pieces together, or is it something like, you know, that's going to take a giant federal effort to get the whole thing made at one time?
Well, it's a little of both. We've been working on this for over a decade now. I could say much longer than that.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the systems that we consider smart grid systems have been in place for decades. The SCADA systems, there are communication systems already built into the system that some people would consider smart grid, depending on what definition you use. And like Eric was saying, at this point, a lot of the oldest infrastructure is starting to fall apart, and it's just a matter of, do we replace that with what we already have and already understand, or do we start to try to use our all of the work that we've done over the last 50 years? We have better information technologies. We have digital meters now instead of the electromechanical ones that give us a lot of abilities that we didn't have before.
Let me ask you both to paint a picture for me. And I'm thinking of a World's Fair. Now, in the old World's Fairs, and the last one I went to was in 64, 65, there were these rides that would take you into the future. We'd see the future of transportation. We'd see the future of food. They give us examples of what that world would look like. Make believe we're creating a ride into the future of the electric grid. And I go by, what are the new things that I would see being operated, how they would operate? What would I be seeing on that ride, Eric? Start that ride up.
Well, first of all, in the far future, I would hope that we don't have to see any physical widgets or and the like. It would just do the right thing. Whatever the customer wants, from their comfort point of view, you know, we have systems that are able to detect that, detect our presence, buy the energy at the lowest possible price, and we don't have to go to websites or buy fancy devices and
working in the background.
It just does the right thing automatically. That would be the far future.
And what would the right thing be? What do we want it to do?
See, that's the trick, because everyone wants to optimize for something different. I may want to have the lowest possible price. My neighbor may have the best reliability always on. Somebody else want to optimize for the smallest impact on the global environment, and other ones just care about the air quality next door. Mm-hmm. So that's the big challenge. We automatically optimizing, but optimizing the optimization is going to be a real challenge.
And Dr. Herter?
Yeah, I think from the consumer's perspective, there are going to be a lot of changes in terms of their choices. I think there'll be a lot more choices for them to take advantage of. One of the place where the smart grid meets the computer, the consumer is the digital meter, of course, that's going on the side of the homes, the smart meters. And the only difference between these new meters and the old meters is that they are able to collect data every hour or every 15 minutes, and that data is transmitted back to the utility. That's really it. It's not too much more than that. I could go into detail, but I won't. And what that allows for is better information about energy use in homes to help educate customers allows them to manage their energy use better. Utilities can now offer websites. They can offer better bills. They can offer more effective energy efficiency programs, rate options. Customers might have the option to purchase smart appliances that work with these energy efficiency programs, rate options. There are already apps for the iPhone or other mobile technologies that provide energy information about your home wherever you are. You can control your appliances from your phone or from some other application on a computer. You can use these for better system management in your home, which increases your options also from the utility side to purchase renewable energy now. If customers have the option to purchase more renewable energy if they're able to manage their loads better because renewable energy is intermittent.
Let me bring in another guest to talk about how some of this technology might help consumers save money, reduce the amount of CO2. Alex Lasky is president and founder of O-Power. He joins us by phone from Arlington, Virginia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ira.
What service do you offer us in saving electricity and managing it better?
Sure. We work with utilities, and now we're working with almost 60 of them across the U.S. to bring to life a little bit of what Karen described, which is that we're taking this data that's coming off smart meters, and in fact, we're taking data off the old-fashioned meters that are read by two-legged meter readers. But we're taking the data, and the data alone isn't that interesting to us, maybe to the geeks on this the radio program, and I know I'm in good company here, it's interesting. But the data alone is not interesting to the overwhelming majority of folks. So what we do is we take the data on behalf of the utility and run analytics and transform that data into interesting insights about each customer, and then under the cover of the utility, deliver better information to customers through the mail, online, through emails, text messages, phone calls, all to begin to identify for customers the opportunities that they have to save. And for each house and for each homeowner or renter, the opportunities are different given both their particular lifestyles as well as the house or apartments they live in.
So you take away all the homework from the consumer.
That's
dealing
right.
with all the numbers and the statistics and things.
That's precisely the case.
Mm-hmm. And do you determine if they have like a swimming pool, for example?
So we try and get our hands on as much data as we possibly can, both from the utility itself, where we get the meter data, and the data coming off of these smart meters is much more interesting because it's coming at a much higher frequency. So we can begin to even identify that there's a swimming pool. But we also go to the county assessor's offices and get all the housing data from each county. So we know not only the particular energy signal coming off of your house, but how old the house is and what the building code likely was, whether there is a swimming pool, or at least whether you have one permitted. The combination of those data sets, we can derive insights.
Doesn't that kind of freak people out to know that you know so much about their homes? They even have a swimming pool, things like that?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, we live in an age where there's, people are pretty, have a pretty realistic understanding that there's a lot of data out there. Certainly, the fact that they have a swimming pool is of no surprise to anyone. It's fairly public, and you can go to Google Maps and figure out who has swimming pools. But people's response is quite the opposite. It's quite positive. People feel like they have a right to know this information. They have a right to know how they're doing, how they compare, what they could be doing to save. If you think about the utility bill that we've all been getting for as long as we've been receiving utility bills, it's absolutely Byzantine. It's impossible, it's inscrutable and impossible to understand. The only thing that you understand when you get your utility bill is, this is how much money I owe, and this is where I send the check. And so the utilities recognize that they need to provide a new level of service in this information age, a service that provides some help and control to the customer. Mm-hmm. And yes, some of that involves getting better data to provide that advice.
All right. We're talking about the infrastructure and the smart grid this hour at Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato talking with Alex Lasky. So then you work for the utility companies. In other words, the consumers don't contact you. You work with
the utility companies.
And you're sort of the intermediary and show the people with the bills where their money is going to and how they might save energy.
That's exactly right. And it's working. We're now we've been up and running for 3 years with our longest running program. We're now, by the end of this year, we will be serving over 10 million households on behalf of utilities across the U.S.
Mm.
The way we know it's working is that, on average, the customers who are receiving these communications, and as you identified, not a single customer signs up for this. We just start delivering the information to customers.
But the average
household is saving between 2 and 3% of their energy use.
Do you
3%. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just going to ask because I'm working with the clock here and I want to get so much to ask. We've talked to psychologists who say that the best way to influence people is to tell them what their neighbors are doing. Your neighbors are saving all this kind of electricity if they do X, Y, Z. Do you use those kinds of information?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We've been using that for 3 years, showing people how they're doing, despite the best parenting jobs. you can't help it, but you're interested in knowing how you're doing and what other people are doing. And in an age where we're overwhelmed with information, we find ourselves modeling our behavior on what we see other people doing.
Mm-hmm. And it works.
It totally works. We are almost at having saved 400 gigawatt hours, which is a big number. It means it's equivalent to powering the Empire State Building for 7 years. We are on path to save people over $200 million in the next 18 months on their electric bills. Mm-hmm. So it's substantial.
All right. So thank you very much, Alex, for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Good luck.
Thank you. Alex Lasky is president and founder of O-Power. He was joining us from Arlington, Virginia. Our number, 1-800-999-8255. Eric, you think that's a good way to work?
Well, yeah, that's when you focus on the consumer side, it's an excellent way to work. The main thing I wanted to point out, though, that is the whole smart metering thing, the end consumer piece, is just one tiny piece of overall smart grid applications and grid modernization. There's a lot of other things that have to be considered besides just that.
And that's what I hope to. We have to go to a break, but that's what I hope to get into when we come back. There's a lot more going on with the grid and modernization. And there are a lot of people who are afraid of the grid. A lot of people say, you know, if you want to have a reliable grid, don't make it bigger, make it smaller. And then when some little piece goes out, you don't have to worry about the rest of the country. So we're going to talk about that all when we get back. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Go to our Facebook page, talk to folks up there. We're discussing it on our homepage at sciencefriday.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Do you disagree with something our guest said? Maybe something even I said. Or maybe you've got a suggestion for a future show. Well, now you can leave us a voicemail on the telephone. Here's that number, 724-374-3063. That's 724-374-3063. And we might just play it during a future show. But there's only one rule. You've got to keep it short. Under 60 seconds. The clock is ticking.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the grid, the electric grid, and smart grid technology. My guests are Karen Herter, president of Herter Energy Research Solutions in El Dorado Hills, California. Eric Gunter, chairman and chief technology officer for Enernex. He's also the senior member of the IEEE, and that's the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and a member of the IEEE's Smart Grid Task Force. When we went to the break, Eric, you mentioned that there's a lot more to the grid than just smart meters. Let's talk about what else there is to the grid and about the new technologies. Give us an example of an old technology and one that is smart grid, how it will replace the old one.
Well, I'm going to go to one that maybe you weren't expecting, but electric vehicles. Okay, so with electric vehicles, old technology replacing fossil fuel transportation. But the impact on the electric grid is something that we've got to plan for and a major aspect of grid modernization. We're moving from a situation where we'd have to charge those vehicles at, let's say, at night, as we would like to, which would be great. But if everyone plugs in at the same time and they don't listen to us and plug it in at night and plug it in at peak, we have the potential for overloading parts of the grid that weren't designed to handle that level of energy flow at that one time. So we need smart grid just to be able to allow us the privilege of moving to electrified transportation, which entails almost every other aspect of demand response. We've experimented with in the past, price response of demand response, direct load control.
Any of those work?
Well, we've been doing it for a number of years on a variety of scales in different areas, and we definitely know that it works.
So if you price electricity higher during the day, they will plug in at night.
That they will. And of course, as I was mentioning earlier, it'd be nice if the electric vehicle knows about the price so I don't have to think about it. I plug it in when the price is low, my dryer will turn on at the right time and use the electric element there, my vehicle will charge at the right time.
One example. Now, give me another example of a new technology.
Well, another new technology is just all the sensors that we use in our system to better manage the electric power assets. Again, these are things that happen behind the scenes, things that we don't see, things that are necessary to keep the system more reliable. So brand new technology, phasor measurement units that allows us to monitor the grid much more effectively than we've done before. So we got a better chance of keeping the lights on longer.
Well, a lot of the problems that happened with the brownouts is that they were human errors. Right? People pulled the wrong levers, pushed the wrong buttons, turned the wrong knobs. Can we do away with some of those human errors in a smarter grid?
Well, the more we rely on technology, the more opportunity there are for both technical failures, but we also run into more potential for a human to put themselves in the loop as well at the cause of problem. I don't think we're going to get rid of that, but certainly by adding more automation, we have the potential for reducing many of these classes of human error.
And what about getting more electricity into the grid? You talked about cars that you can use it, but we're now having solar and wind and things like that.
Good segue to what I wanted to also mention, rooftop photovoltaics, an obvious example. Pretty soon we'll be able to buy whole kits from Home Depot and be able to put them on. A lot of people installing them. Again, the grid needs to be modernized in many ways in order to give us the privilege to do that. Most parts of the power grid, especially the distribution system, was not designed for putting energy into the grid. And there's a lot that goes into figuring out whether it can handle it or not. And, of course, who's going to pay for the privilege to allow us to, make a little bit of money, maybe injecting that into the grid, or to participate in the greening of our energy sources?
Karen Herter, what I hear Eric is saying is it's going to cost money to build more power capability so that my wind farm that I'd never had before can now hook up to the grid. Who's going to pay for that?
Well, everybody has to pay for that at some point, because there's a great need at this point for more renewables in the system. And whether it's regulatory, whether it's energy independence, the environment, or domestic job growth, it's an important part of our energy future is renewables. The intermittency of renewables makes it a bit of a management nightmare, trying to get the solar is shining when we need it, or the wind is blowing when we need it. We can't do that. So what we do need to do is have smarts in the grid to be able to fill the valleys and to reduce those peaks so that we have a stable system.
Let's go to Logan in Richfield, Ohio. Hi, Logan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Hi, Ira. I know it's partly my Amish background, but I think we're really going in the wrong direction with the computerized grid. And certainly the grid has to be brought up to date, but the centralization where the grid is controlled by computer systems is so scary. Stuxnet is just the first word I'd throw out there. When you can close down grids or portions of the grid from someplace in Iran Iran just had a Stuxnet, from someplace else in the world, we expose ourselves to threats. Ira, if people were good and systems were engineered properly and engineers were smart, we wouldn't have a thing to worry about in the world. But people aren't good and systems aren't always working the way they they should work.
There are some smart engineers, I must throw in there in their defense.
I've got two daughters who are biochemists, Iris, so I know there's smart people out there. But
I got your point. Let me get an answer to that. It's a good question. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that distributed command and control, much more distributed, is a way to deal with a lot of those issues. We've had in the history of the running the grid now has been centralized for all this time. There are large exceptions of where we have a lot of intelligence out on the edges of the grid, but distributing things more so that
What do you mean? So you have separate control points, or you can block out something from crossing over?
Basically more autonomous control. So when we're trying to optimize various parts of the grid in one area, have that out in the remote substations that are out there and let them automate as much of that as possible to protect the system so that issues and these kind of problems can't propagate very quickly and widely.
Karen, you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Is this a legitimate concern that we had from our caller?
Yes. Absolutely a legitimate concern, and Eric is right that more distributed systems is a good idea. And another way to avoid that kind of concern, I think a lot of people are concerned about the utility reaching out and controlling their appliances, and that's what the smart grid is. That's not necessarily what the smart grid is. There are other ways to incent customers to change their loads, for example, if you give them pricing. And there's really those two ways. Right now, we have load control programs. Most utilities have air conditioning load control programs. They pay customers for the ability to manage their air conditioning use. Yeah. But if you just set the right price signal is another option. And then as long as customers are given the option of those two choices, then there shouldn't be any trouble.
You know, you have to know that you have that option. I know, for example, on my dishwasher, it'll say start in 4 hours. Now, that could be in the middle of the night and where the load is lower. Sometimes we have to be given that option, right, Derek, to know that we can do that.
Well, you know that you can do it, know that it makes a difference. And, of course, having the regulatory elements in place so that you have pricing that can give you a break at night so that you can make that decision and save some money. But if you don't want to, you want to pay through and do the wash or whatever when you want to, hey, you can pay for it.
We also have to have a commitment to build the grid, don't we? I mean, if we've talked to farmers and cattlemen and ranchers over the years who have their own wind power and solar power. They want to hook up to the grid, but the grid ends 5 meters away from their little endpoint.
Yeah, access, especially for wind power, is an issue. Most of the wind occurs in areas where there's limited transmission capability. So in order to provide more wind, we have to build the transmission. But again, someone's got to pay for that. So you've got to do a very detailed cost-benefit analysis on how to...
But you would think this creates jobs. We're talking about creating jobs in America. Building the grid would seem to be the kind of... You could create lots of different kinds of jobs in every different kind of industry.
And especially with infrastructure. We've got a lot of bridges to build and fix, and we've got a lot of portions of our electric infrastructure that needs to be upgraded and replaced just to keep it running, let alone try to capture more renewable energy.
1-800-999-8255. Let's go to Ted in Little Egg, New Jersey. Hi, Ted.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey there.
I had a comment on the program that's going right now.
Sure, go ahead.
We're talking about smart grids and saving money here and there. It was kind of interesting. Last year, I got a letter from my utility company. It's kind of a paradox. They mentioned that demand was down because of the power saving, more efficient air conditioning units, CFL bulbs. And since the demand was down, our rates were going to go up. So it kind of washes out the savings by decreasing demand, but then the rates go up at the same time. So, I'd like to have them comment on.
Right. Why is it in the interest of power companies to sell you less power?
Well, that always is an interesting one. People talk about, I've got a business selling energy, and, I'm going to pay people to use less. I mean, there's a little contradictory normal thinking every once in a while. But the fact is it's really related to it's much more expensive for us to develop and generate energy during the peak times than it is in the evening. So getting well-structured programs together, preferably price responsive, demand response, so that you can shift the usage and even it out and take the maximum advantage of the capacity of our system is what we would like to do.
Now, why can't we integrate, the things that are burgeoning now, and everybody loves their smartphones, your iPhone, your Android. Why can't I now, away from my home, start adjusting things on that or having my home talk to me through my phone?
Well, I certainly can do that on mine, and folks that know me know that I do it all the time.
What's that?
I can do it on my iPad. I can do it on my iPhone. You know, those technologies have been around for a long time. My home has been automated for about 15 years, and I've had a web interface to it for a little over 10. So.
Yeah, but you know the right people.
Right, exactly right. So it can be done. But now we have people that sell you, you know, stuff that you can do that now, and it's becoming much more available. You can buy some of these things at your Home Depot store.
Well, why doesn't the utility company help us with that? Or give us a rate decrease if we buy this stuff to spur us, or maybe a tax break or something like that?
Well, again, from the utility point of view, there's a certain amount of cost of what it takes to generate energy at different times of the day. And in our regulated environment is passed on to the consumer. What we need to be able to do is to get consumers through their technology to understand when it's better to use energy more and less, and so that we can reduce that overall infrastructure cost.
Michael in Patagonia, Arizona. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the use of the smart meters. I think they're an awesome technology to be able to get feedback on our usage. However, I wanted to bring up a drawback in the compulsory installing of these wireless meters on our homes. My wife has a severe environmental illness and has an electromagnetic energy sensitivity, and having a smart meter in our home is something that we could never do.
All right,
and there are more and more people out there like that who cannot handle or have debilitating physical effects from having those wireless meters put on their homes.
All right, Michael, let me take your call and just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Karen Herter, there are a lot of people who are scared of electric meters, of
right.
the wireless. And does he have a legitimate concern?
You know, I'm not a biophysicist, so I can't answer that directly. But his concern is real, and a lot of people have the same concern. What I can tell you is what the experts say, and what the experts say that it is there's no major health effect from the meters. That the level of RF that comes from a smart meter is much, much lower than what you would get from a standard cell phone. In addition, that's only when they're transmitting meters. These meters only transmit data for about 3 minutes in the middle of the night. EPRI did a study just this year in front of they put 10 meters together, and then they measured the RF from those meters.
The radio
and
frequencies found, coming out.
Sorry, yes, yeah. the radio frequency. And they found that the level at 1 foot away in front of the meters when it was transmitting was less than 10% of the FCC safety limit. And behind the meter, which is where you would be living, right, in your home, it was less than 1% of the FCC safety limit. So right now, the empirical evidence isn't there that it causes any trouble, but certainly the concerns are out there, and concerns are always real, and they should be addressed.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-99-8255. You're shaking your head, Eric.
I totally agree. The concerns are real, we have to be able to deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people, the more they learn about smart meters, smart grids, things like that?
Well, I mean, people fundamentally, most people don't like change. So, people find all sorts of interesting ways to resist it. In this case, the fear of the unknown is certainly an issue. But in this particular one, there's a lot more things that I would personally be more concerned about. RF exposure from microwave ovens, from your cell phone, my BlackBerry, and everything else.
But they're also worried about their invasion of privacy.
And, well, the privacy thing is certainly one that's come up several times, and people thinking that the government is looking into their home and the like. And of course, our utilities are, the investor owns are not government run. And this is something that that we're trying to provide through smart metering and these capabilities, giving consumers the tools that they choose, if they want to utilize to better manage their energy and usage and cost.
Well, with all the things that are on people's minds, how do you get this? How do you get this people to pay attention to this? Do we have to wait for a brownout? And something this summer?
Well, I can argue that a lot of the current interest in smart grid today is a direct result of a chain of events that occurred after the August blackout of 2003. We started talking about smart meters in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and we talked about smart grid in the Energy Independence Act of 2007, got some money behind it with ARA funding, but it all evolved, I think, from a that blackout. So,
Dr. Herter, do you agree?
Not quite. I would say it evolved more from the California energy crisis in 2000-2001. Was when there were a lot of blackouts. There were good folks at the Energy Commission under Art Rosenfeld who did a lot of work on smart meters and dynamic pricing, and I think that was really the catalyst, and that's what blossomed into the current smart grid movement.
Well, thank you both for the intelligent discussion. Thank you. Very interesting. I want to thank both of my guests. Eric Gunther is chairman and chief technology officer for Enernex. He's also a senior member of the IEEE. That's the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, and a member of the IEEE Smart Grid Task Force. Karen Herter is president of Herter Energy Research Solutions in El Dorado Hills, California. Thank you both for taking time. Have a good weekend to both of you.
Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.